I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
They can't afford to have an independent programmer monitoring me. Do you realize how many outside systems I've gone into? How many programs I've appropriated?
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
God, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the February 6th edition of the In and Out Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with...
VR, doing the later show.
The later show. All right, well, we're back again with another show for everyone and their interesting listening minds. Going to give a shout-out to Cessna out there. I know you're waiting for the show, and I'm getting this one up just for you.
Otherwise, we could have waited a day or two.
Yeah, we really got that message, and I was like, oh, my gosh, we need to get this going.
Cause we really need to be responsible. Thank you.
Yes. So we've been extremely busy, me and VR, extremely busy lives, but we're not going to quit on the show. And
I've been busier than a one-legged man in a butt-kicking contest.
Yeah,
that
me too.
I spend a lot of time on the floor.
Yeah, and I'll be wrapping up here with school pretty soon. A few other things, but still bringing the news as usual. And also we're going to be bringing an interview from the guys over at Dinner Zone on the next show to talk about the conference that they got going on over there. So that should be pretty interesting to have that. And on to the news. Okay, well, we talked about in one of the previous shows about how Google was interested into picking up some dark fiber, and I believe they did end up picking up some dark fiber. Well, there has been some speculation as to what was the purpose for them in doing that, and this may be it here. Google revolutionized the Internet. Now it is hoping to do the same with our phones. The company behind the U.S.-based internet search engine looks set to launch a free telephone service that links users via a broadband internet connection using a headset in a home computer. The technology will enable Google to move in on the market has been around for some time. Software by the London-based company Skype has been downloaded nearly 54 million times around the world, and but no large telecommunication firms have properly exploited it.
So it sounds like Google's going to take over and become their own telephone company.
Kind of. BT, which connects 7 out of 10 British, which is BT's British Telecom, British households, has developed its own internet telephone service. However, the telephone giant, which has most to lose if the new technology takes off, has been reluctant to promote it heavily. Julian Hewitt, senior partner at Ovum, a telecoms consultancy, said, from a telecoms perspective, there is a big appeal in the fact that Google is a search operation, and of course the Google brand is a huge draw. Mr. Hewitt said that Google telephone service could be made to link with Google search engine, which already conducts half of the internet inquiries made around the world. A surfer looking for a clothes retailer could simply find the website and click on the screen and speak to the shop.
Wow, what a great thing.
Yeah, the basic cost of making calls across the internet is almost nil. The real cost in developing the software after that, the service exploits available internet capacity. However, charging does become necessary to link internet calls with the traditional phone network. In addition, the sound quality of the calls across the internet can be poor and the connections can be less reliable. A recent advert by Google on its website calls for a strategic negotiator to help the company to provide a global backbone network, a high-capacity infrastructure, or international infrastructure. By investing in capacity, Google could circumvent the problems.
Yeah, well, you know, just by sheer amount of connections, they can take care of a lot of the, you know, the fidelity problems.
of quality and reliability and guarantee better service. Especially with some of the large internet broadband connections that you're getting nowadays compared to dial-up and all the times that people were using chat over the internet then, it was pretty bad. Although Google is reluctant to talk about its plans, the logical use of such a network would be to help to support a new telephone service. The company would buy capacity cheaply by taking up slack capacity left behind when the internet bubble collapsed in 2001. Around the world, thousands of miles of pre-fiber optic cable remain unused because of the amount of speculation development vastly exceeded demand. Such capacity would be available at rock-bottom prices today. Elsewhere in the world, using the internet to make phone calls has caught on more quickly. In Japan, 10% of households already have use the so-called voice over internet protocol. I don't know why they say so-called. That's what it is.
Yes, voice over IP.
And an internet service offered by SoftBand has 4.4 million subscribers. Its growth has depressed revenues in the local telecom group NTT. In the U.S., a company called Vonage offers customers unlimited calls each month for as little as $24. Big companies and multinationals that make huge numbers of long-distance calls are also increasingly switching to internet calls to try to slash their bills. Google, which has been founded in 1996, built its business from scratch, yada, yada, yada. So that's kind of an interesting idea, kind of how like Yahoo has integrated their traffic reporting results into maps and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, bringing everyone onto the net slowly and surely in every fashion. So that's pretty interesting. I think that it's going to be a very popular thing because, you know, once you get to this type of global network and it's can, you know, go Wi-Fi, you can, you know, go wireless, you can be plugged in somewhere, wherever it is, and you get access to this information. It's a matter of now just where do the clients go, you know. Look up this store while, you know, have a passenger in your car, look up the store. Maybe you do it by voice command and then says, would you like to talk to the store or the restaurant or make reservations? And you press a button and you're connected and you're talking. And it's definitely going to come. And I think that, you know, these types of things have already been worked on probably for this last year, for sure. And it's a coming thing. I think that will be in society.
Yep. We're all going to be plugged in, tuned in, and
watched.
That's right.
So, behave. And also, this is kind of an interesting story as well that kind of goes along with the whole voice over IP and communications over the internet. It's a company called Belster, and what it is this.
Is it kind of like Napster and the phone company all put in together?
Yes.
I'll
tell you how.
All right.
Basically, it's a peer-to-peer communications network that empowers people to share a phone line with other like-minded individuals around the world for free. Okay?
It's kind of like a global party line.
Well, you know, if you use voice over IP, let's say I'm on my computer, and I have this program where I'm talking, right? And I want to talk to somebody else. But let's just say I want to dial a phone number, and I go from my client program to, let's say, somebody in Alaska. And their computer in Alaska is connected to the phone line. So I can call Alaska, which I'll go through this program on my computer. It'll go to a program with somebody who's located in Alaska. And then it'll actually dial out from their phone to another local number in Alaska of the person that I really want to talk to, who maybe doesn't have a computer. And then I'm able to speak to that person, and it's a local call, and it doesn't cost anybody. So what this is, from my understanding, is that all these people are hooked up, and they're allowing their landlines to be dial-outs in areas.
Oh, for people who want to call in that area.
Yeah, and it'll be a local call.
That's beautiful.
Belster is a peer-to-peer communication network that empowers people to share a phone line with other like-minded individuals around the world for free. Those who share access to a line in turn have the ability to access the lines of all of other nodes around the world. This is a non-commercial activity designed to help to help connect people with people and maximize the value of the network. The Belster network manages the Active Directory of available endpoints and routes the calls across the organic communications network that makes up Belster.
Organic.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of strange.
Yeah, I thought that's pretty cool. It's actually a metaphor for the whole thing, and just
it's a growing thing.
Yeah, it's not heavily regulated. It's because it's random, it's voluntary.
Belster launch was weekend of January 22nd this year, and at this time of the article of actually it was January 5th. There were 222 registered nodes out there, and number of active nodes at that time was 46, so people are on there using it. Belster was influenced by the goals of the original Free World Dial-Up project that started in October 1995, which the beta launch of Belster.net, we are finally able to offer a peer-to-peer network where members of the network can share their PSTN access and each with each other. Think of the ham radio phone patch, where it's a ham radio and it's actually patched into the phone.
Yeah.
That uses the internet to connect two people together. Belster is based on Asterisk, which we've talked about before, which is kind of a PBX system for Linux. So that is, it's great. It's the convergence of these technologies, and people are now looking at the obvious. I mean, we could have probably done this like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, with the introduction of broadband and getting like decent connection speeds. But
well, actually, some of that was already being done, like back in the BBS days. It was much more difficult.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been kind of startups, so now I think people are adopting it and understanding that some things that have been tried to have been done before, they just didn't have a piece of the technology yet they're missing to make it really work well. And
I think it's more actually just cultural, of being able to people understand that, I don't have to pay to use the backbone, the internet, and I can just connect into a local line and call for free. It's great.
Yeah, and that's also coming about from the whole voice over IP thing, and companies adopting it, and it's kind of funny when you think that, you're like, man, how come this idea wasn't thought of before, but faster PC speeds and more ability and more bandwidth and all that stuff is allowing for all these things to be able to take shape and run with little problem. Okay, yes. All right. Moving along. Yeah. I didn't know this until looking into it the other day, but there's a few websites out there where you can actually pay to view a movie.
Oh, wow.
There's Cinema Something and there's a Movie Something. I forget the names of both of them. If you Google them up, like watching movies online, I should have done that. Actually, no, I can do that while we're here. But what it is you would go to their website, and instead of renting the movie from a movie store or getting it from Netflix and they send it to you, you just watch it right there, off the internet. And they have, I've looked at previews too, and you can, if you have a decent connection, you can actually get DVD quality on your monitor. Or if you have a friend of mine has a PC hooked into his room and the living room, and he has it running 640 by 480 on his monitor, or on his television set, and he's able to look at movies or, whatever he chooses to download, or, play MP3s.
But yeah, you can just transfer it over to his TV.
Yeah. Here, I'm going to Google this up here.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I might start actually watching movies now.
Yeah, and some of the, some of them are $2, some of them are, $4, just depends on the movie. I didn't see anything more than $4. Let's see, the one I didn't really look at, here's, I think this is it, MovieFlix is one, I didn't really look at that one so much, something called Cinema Something, Cinema Movie, I don't know, but maybe this is a, no, that's not it, but, no, you can definitely check out the internet and Google that up. Let's see. I'm pretty much trying to figure out how we can do this. Nope, that's not it. All right, well, if I find it a little bit later, I'll give it out there. But this next article is in relation to that. Basically, Napster is considering remaking itself as a movie download site, too. Speaking in at the MIDM Music Conference, Napster CEO Chris Gorug said the company was considering offering movies alongside its current catalog of some 1 million music tracks. We are currently considering moving into video, particularly to tap the younger video game generation, he told delegates, according to Financial Times. I do think that while there are huge players in the delivery of movies like Sky, there could be a role for Napster. Oh, you know what? Here we go. It's one of them's in here. The online movie distribution has taken off to a small degree in the U.S. with Movie Link and Cinema Now selling films via the web from $2.99 and upwards. So it's at MovieLink.com, CinemaNow.com. Movie Link is backed by major cinemas, including MGM Studios, Paramount Pictures, Sony Pictures Entertainment, Universal Studios, and Warner Brothers Studios. While Cinema Now is a big name partner that has big name partners, including Disney and Microsoft. So you can check those out on there. So if you have a decent internet connection and don't feel like giving your card information out over the internet, then check it out.
Yeah.
And you can actually, one of them, I think it's, maybe it's Cinema Now, you can download the movie and have it for a day.
Well, see, that's even nicer.
Yeah, it uses the DRM technology, digital rights management technology, in media player. Yeah, it's Cinema Now, I believe, and you can download it and keep it for a day.
Well, yeah, that's pretty cool.
And when I did see, when you're downloading it too, you can hit pause and play, and all that. So I think you hit pause. I don't know how long you can hit pause for. But, yeah.
Yeah, I like that even better. It's not like just streaming in.
And you can also see previews. So, like, here, let's check this. Well, that's a checkout. Let's go back to the preview. Well, you guys can't see this, but me in VR can see this. Yeah, but you can check out all sorts of stuff, even post reviews. Not too shabby. Okay, all right. Oh, yeah, there you go. Like, watch the trailer.
Yes. Let's see how good your connection is.
Yeah. This is dead air for everybody else.
Dead air.
Dead air. Okay, my firewall's going to let this thing go through. Okay.
Oh, right on.
That's not too bad, huh?
No, it's a little grainy, but not too bad.
I think that's actually the film itself, because this is an older film.
Oh, it could be.
All right, well, we're going to move on. But, yeah, you could definitely check that out and see if you want to do that yourself as an alternative to going down the store or waiting for Netflix to ship you tape. All right, well, the FBI shuts down its unclassified email system, which is FBI.gov. Now, I do believe, let's see, their typical email is at the FBI.gov server. Yeah, and that's their public server. That's not what they use for internal use. The Bureau is investigating whether someone had hacked into the FBI.gov email system, which is run by a private company, officials said. We use these accounts to communicate with you folks, view internet sites, and conduct other non-sensitive bureau issues, our business, such as sending out press releases. Special Agent Steve Lazarus, the FBI's media coordinator in Atlanta, said in an email describing the problem, the FBI computer system that is used for case files, classified and sensitive information, and internal communications is unaffected. The Bureau is also in the process of switching its email accounts, officials said. Lawmakers and Justice Department Inspector General have criticized the FBI for taking too much time and spending too much money to upgrade its computer systems. This is kind of a long conversation about that software that they've been working on for quite some time to make everything uniform there, and all their upgrades and all that good stuff. So
well, and they just was it they're getting rid of was that Carnivore as well?
Yeah, but I think that was a while ago that they had gotten rid of Carnivore. That was up to 2 years ago, I believe. But you know, who knows? And they said they've been using more, of course, more third-party applications and hardware and software out there.
It just sounds like they're doing a lot of inefficient stuff with their IT.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard going from, I mean, I know from working in consulting, I know you try to take one business from what they're used to doing and say, hey, you need to move over to doing this style of thing, and there's this change, and they're actually pretty small changes. And I'm sure with the FBI, they're probably fairly large changes, policy changes and how information's handled and stuff like that. But even in the sense of small changes, a lot of people just don't like to change because they know their job in and out, and then when it moves, you know,
it's like having a whole new job.
Yeah.
I gotta relearn and retrain and oh my, I gotta think.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's very problemsome for many of those people. Okay. All right, well, moving on to next information. Now this I found very interesting, and this could be a major milestone in the way that we build electronics. Well, not how we build electronics, but this particular piece, how it may affect the world electronics. Basically, HP is saying that we have the next transistor.
Oh, wow.
They call it the crossbar latch. Hewlett-Packard said that its researchers have proven that a technology they invented could eventually replace a transistor, a fundamental building block of computers. Now, there's actually some conspiracy theory out there that the technology for a transistor actually came from the Roswell incident.
That's been around for quite some time.
Yeah, a lot of people
It's very fun, though.
Yeah, a lot of people don't believe that the transistor was just invented by us. They said it's too ahead of its time. And
integrated circuit boards, too.
Yeah.
Capacitors.
In a paper published in the Journal of Applied Physics, HP said three of its members of its quantum science research group proposed to demonstrate a crossbar latch, which provides the signal restoration and inversion required for general computing without the need for transistors. HP Research said in a statement that the technology could result in computers that are thousands of times more powerful than those that exist today. We are reinventing the computer at a molecular scale, said Stan Williams, one of the authors of the paper, in a statement. The crossbar latch provides a key element needed for building a computer using nanometer-sized devices that are relatively inexpensive and easy to build.
Wow.
Isn't it interesting saying building at the nanometer, you know?
Yeah.
I don't even know how they
building
do that.
Building it at the molecular level.
Yeah. A few QKs, I don't know how to say that. Another one of the paper's authors said in a statement that the transistor would continue to be used for years to come with conventional silicon circuits. But he added that this could someday replace transistors in computers, but just as transistors replaced vacuum tubes and vacuum tubes replaced electromagnetic relays before them.
Yeah. It's not going to be like one massive revolution. It's going to also be cost-driven and production-driven and demand-driven.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, all these things. You know, they talk about, like, you know, see-through, you know, screens that we could, you know, crystal screens that we can work off of, kind of like that one movie with Tom Cruise. What was that?
Oh, that was...
where they predicted the murders before they happened.
Oh, false positive. Minority Report.
Minority Report. I don't know why that skipped my mind, but that's it. Yeah. So those things are just continually happening out there, and new things are being discovered all the time, and it's just interesting to watch this world grow and to see where things are going to go. And not too far off in the future, we're going to see some pretty exciting things. Things are accelerating fast. And a lot of new social issues that we're going to have to deal with, which is one of the main reasons we have this show. I've kind of defined the show to the social impact of what, you know, the impact of what technology creates on our social world and in our world in general. And it's changing rapidly all the time. So, all right. The fun thing is hearing all these people learn new buzzwords and walk around like they really know what they're saying.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of the show.
Yeah. Because VR knows all the buzzwords.
That's right. I walk around going, oh, I'm the greatest IT guy ever. I know we're going to be building a new computers. A gigawatt box. from the molecular level up.
You're like, sir, what you need is a quantum computer. Now, I can build you that, but it's going to cost a little extra.
Just a little extra.
Yeah.
About 1.2 mil.
Yeah. So, 1.2 gigawatts. very interesting stuff. Yeah, I actually built somebody. Man, I was jealous. I built this guy this computer the other day, and it's pretty rocking. AMD 64. It had like 4 gigs of RAM. It was a monster. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can buy new computers. I typically don't buy new computers. I just kind of take, like, last year's big hot technology and use that because...
Yeah, he Frankensteins them together. You should see the weird freaking Jacob's Ladder thing we're using right now.
Oh, gosh.
He's actually got this whole huge...
spinning wheel of, like, shooting electricity and...
Yeah, he's actually got this special thing to actually cut out all the noise and static electricity, which... shooting off this thing, it's actually really scary.
Oh, gosh.
That's why no one else does the show. It's just I have no fear of death.
Yeah.
And so I don't mind sitting over here and having, you know, like, shock, you know, the electricity jump on either side of my head at any time. Don't care.
Whatever. All right.
It's great fun.
Actually, I think I have a pretty clean setup here.
Yeah, besides all the spinning electromagnetics.
All right. Well, a study has been done, and it shows that there's more identity theft done offline than online.
Oh, I don't doubt that at all, because there's less ways to trace it offline.
And it's a lot easier just to dig in somebody's trash.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Federal regulators warn that the Internet is the thriving frontier for identity theft, but 72% of thefts of personal information from scams last year was done offline.
That sounds exactly what the normal police, the police mentality. Ooh, there's something really easy we can blame it on. Let's blame it all on it.
Yeah.
But it's not even close to being the majority of what's doing it.
Yeah, he drives that car. He must be doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Identity.
It's all about the Internet. They don't even do, more than 25%.
Yeah. Identity theft, the practice of stealing someone's personal information and running up the bills in their name, cost Americans $52.6 billion last year. Thieves got their victims' bank and credit card information online. In just 12% of the cases, identity thieves are making a killing electronically. They're picking through trash and numbing through stolen or lost wallets, said James Van Dyke, principal analyst at Javelin Strategy and Research, a Pleasanton, California financial consulting firm. Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That conducted the study. Friends, family members, and neighbors account for half of all known thieves. So I'm pretty worried about VR.
That's and right.
On average, it cost a consumer $15,607.
What was the average one?
$15,607.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. That compares with $2,320 for an online huckster. While some customers fear logging on to gain access to financial accounts for security concerns, the Internet is the best way to catch fraud early, he said. Americans are slowly becoming aware that monitoring account balances via the Internet beats waiting out the 30-day paper mail cycle for statements,
yeah,
which might not reach their hands. When victims discovered fraud through the Internet, their loss was $551. But when they realized that the fraud would only received only after receiving mailed statements, it cost them $4,543, the report said. The Federal Trade Commission is now fielding more inquiries than complaints about the identity theft, a sign that consumers are taking steps to protect themselves. A Javelin survey of 38 questions was based on telephone interviews with 4,000 consumers, including 509 victims of identity fraud. Yeah.
Yep.
That's why I need a shredder. You know, since I've been here, I had the grill at the last place. I actually just put my stuff on the grill.
Yeah.
And would burn it up. And now I don't have a shredder, and I rip it up myself, and I need to get a shredder.
Yeah, I actually still have the fire pit. It's fun.
You know,
roasting marshmallows off the credit card applications. They give them such this nice plastic
It's the ink, man, that really gives the flavor.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
And especially magazines, you know, they actually add some clay into the paper to make them glossier. Oh, that's tasty.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty toxic, actually. I've been around that and inhaled some of that smoke, and it's pretty bad. I should have a fireplace, but screw that. All right.
But it burns in such pretty colors.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, moving along. The HP focuses on, calls it paparazzi-proof cameras, but basically what the article amounts to is saying that if you take a picture with your cell phone, it could go back. A lot of cell phones, if you take a picture, some, and I'm thinking, because I don't have one for sure, but I think I've seen this, it stores the files at their like web server or whatever.
Yeah.
It goes back to their computers. It doesn't really store it on the phone. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but
so you could actually like hack the server and view other people's pictures.
What this really talks about is what HP invented was this software that if you take a picture, let's say somebody takes a picture of me and you, but we have said that we do not want our pictures to be taken, it will blur our faces out. It will not allow the user of that phone to keep our picture.
Oh, wow. But where do we have to say we don't want our pictures taken?
Well, they don't have that technology out in the public.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, there'd be some area.
That's beautiful. Where do I sign up for that?
Yeah. The good news is that you can keep the camera in your cell phone. Bad news is anyone who wants to turn it off can turn it off. At least that's the way it might work if technology described by Hewlett-Packard makes it into the market. A recent patent application from the computing giant, describes a system in which digital cameras would be equipped with circuits that could be remotely triggered to blur the face of any images captured by the camera. A U.S. patent application 2004-0202382 filed in April 2003 and published in October 2004 describes a system in which an image captured by a camera could be automatically modified based on commands sent by a remote device. In short, anyone who doesn't want their photo taken at a particular time could hit a clicker to ensure that any camera or camera-equipped gadgets in range got only a fuzzy outline of their face.
Yeah, so what's really where the moneymaker is getting that little clicker. It goes, you know, you just start clicking that thing, and anybody taking a picture at that time, it blurs out your picture, your face.
Well, when they say hit a clicker, I mean, they're saying just taking the picture. Maybe they might say that it costs a service to have your face blocked out.
That could be.
You know. A system that allowed people to selectively opt out of having their photo taken would address such privacy concerns without restoring to many draconian measures, such as banning cameras, as numerous authorities have done with camera-equipped mobile phones. You'd still have to ban a camera phone if you didn't want to take a picture of a facility, though.
Yeah.
An HP representative said that the company had no current plans to commercialize technology, which would require widespread adoption by camera makers and possibly government mandates to be financially practical. I honestly don't see it coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems to it, because, you know, it could be overdone. It
could be a large database to search. And I honestly think they have to send the image back to a server that would do all the work and then send it back to you. So when you take a picture, it didn't go to your phone and went to the server, and the server analyzed everything, and then it sent it back to you.
Yeah, because otherwise you could use the
camera. How's your phone going to comprehend all that, you know?
Because you could have a camera phone that you don't actually have any service with, and you have a picture of it.
Yeah, that too as well.
It won't modify it.
And then one thing is, too, is do you really want your... Now, if that's how it works, and that's how I'm guessing, that it would have to work that way, would you also want all your pictures being sent back someplace else, you know, for this computer to look at it?
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that be fun to be an employee there? Be like
Friday and
Saturday nights, or like, you know,
oh my,
Mardi Gras night? You know, you want to see what these people are taking pictures of. And so,
I think that would be a great service. Of like, you know, pay for, you know, a couple cents for some good pictures here and there that you get sent by people's camera phones. Just takes like a dollar or two off your bill.
It'd be interesting if they had actually camera phones where they take these pictures and they said, do you allow this picture to be anonymously published to the web?
Yeah.
And like you could just go surf, you know, that'd be like the biggest like hot or not or next site for people to waste all their work day looking at. All right. Well,
see, I need a job like that where I can spend all my day just surfing the internet. Not doing anything.
Sure. You should be a porn analyst.
Hey, that sounds like a new career.
A new career, yeah. Now
that money shot needed to be a little better in this way.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's just not doing it for me. Look, can you have her with blonde hair this time?
Yeah.
Okay.
That porn pop really needed more distance.
Oh gosh. Look, that was really good, but if you could put it in slow-mo, okay, that, you know.
Yeah, that's better.
Oh my gosh.
That style.
All right. Well, pirated Windows copies to get fewer fixes. Now, I believe mentioning something like this before, and now it seems like they've done and gone with it. Microsoft Corp plans to severely curtail the ways in which people running pirated copies of its dominant Windows operating system can receive software updates, including security fixes. The new authentication system announced is due to arrive mid-year, will still allow people with pirated copies of Windows to obtain security fixes, but their options will be limited. Let's see. They expect Microsoft to eventually cut out the security update avenue for pirated copies, and said that the company may feel it has few options as it tries to stop the millions of users who are running pirated copies of Windows. The operating system is one of the company's major cash cows, and the move comes as Microsoft is moving aggressively into emerging markets where piracy is thought to be more common. Yeah, you know, I don't know. There's two sides to that thing. You turn off the updates, and now you just have more virus-ridden computers spewing out crap.
Yeah, which just proliferate the whole problem in general.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they're going to find a way around it anyways. You know, so you might as well just let them have their security updates and have less crap on the internet. So, because they really need those updates.
That they do.
All right. You know, let me move this one here to the front. This one is, me and VR kind of get into these scientific things. Enjoy them. This one talks about an animal-humid hybrid sparks controversy.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, that's been illegalized a lot of places, and it's, you know, by so many different conventions, it's, you know, faux pas and all that.
Yeah, it is, but it's still being done to some degree. Scientists have blurred the line between human and animal by producing chimeras, a hybrid creature that's part human and part animal.
Let me define hybrid. Let me see if this is still using this correctly. Is typically, in biological terms, a cell, it's a nucleus, which contains both, or DNA, the whole genome. So, like, if it has, let's say it's pig and human, it has the full genome for pig and the full genome for human. Or the whole genetic code. So it's all 47 and all, like, 32.
Well, I heard a hybrid is, it could be that, but I heard also could be, you know, a portion of, like, two aspects.
That's a combination, or I forget what the biological...
Not two aspects, but one aspect is covered in one and another aspect is covered in another.
Well, that's just, you know, what's that called again? It'll come to me one of these days.
Chinese scientists at the Shanghai Second Medical University in 2003 successfully fused human cells with rabbit eggs. The embryos were reportedly the first human-animal chimeras successfully created. They were allowed to develop for several days in a laboratory dish before the scientists destroyed the embryos to harvest their stem cells. In Minnesota last year, researchers at the Mayo Clinic created pigs with human blood flowing through their bodies. And at Stanford University in California, an experiment might be done later this year to create mice with human brains. That'd be a big head on a mouse.
That's like the rats of NIMH.
Yeah.
What a great thing. Feed them candy bars. It'll be fun.
I love that movie. I need to buy that. Scientists feel that more human-like the animal, the better research model it makes for testing drugs, or possibly growing spare parts such as livers to transplant into humans, watching how humans...
So you know what that means? Drink more!
Yeah, drink more. care less about responsibility.
We can grow a new liver. That's great.
We'll just fuse a rat brain to your head, and you'll be set.
That might be a really great treatment for, Alzheimer's. That usually have a little rat brain that just produces good old fresh,
I think just let the guy die. stop pumping fluids and crap into him to keep him around. Scientists feel that watching how human cells mature and interact in a living creature may also lead to discoveries of new medical treatments. But creating human-animal chimeras named after a monster in Greek mythology that has a lion's head and a goat's body and a serpent's tail has raised troubling questions. What new subhuman combination should be produced and for what purpose? And at what point would it be considered human? And what rights, if any, should they have?
Yeah. Now, cockroach and human? Bad combination.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be smart and survive anywhere. Yeah, bad.
Yeah, to me, I don't know, how to give a general statement to draw an outline of what should be and shouldn't be done. But I honestly believe that there are definitely limits. And once you start blurring the line of what humanity can be, I think really everything can spiral out of control after that.
Yeah, well, it really goes into, the whole rat, the mouse brain thing is that's really pushing the edge towards, where we shouldn't go, because at least that doesn't even closely have the brain to weight ratio that we do, and seems to be what's actually one of the main telltale things of to be a social and intelligent creature. It's a brain to weight ratio of 1 to 60. But because otherwise we start, if we start using them for a slave race, then that's that's morally and ethically wrong. And economically, for that matter. Or if we just have these things which just produces arms and livers and hearts and lungs and all that, that's great. It's like an organ tree. What a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But do we have to kill it? That's what's interesting. Now, do we have to kill it to harvest our own organs from it? Or can we actually do it eventually? So it's like plucking an apple off a tree.
Yeah, when I first was reading that and thinking a little deeper along the lines of what could happen one day, it almost seems like it would get to the point where we're integrating electronics into our heads and enhancing ourselves, and it just sounds like we turn into the Borg.
Yeah. Yeah, I really do. But we're eventually going to have to, unless we do some genetic engineering, because we're all going to have to be hooked up to machines in order to, to survive, because our genetic pool is... we've taken ourselves out of, natural selection. So, the non, really viable, organs and cells keep producing. And so we get cancer. It's the same, that's really the stuff we need to start looking at.
Yeah, I don't know. They actually, we talked about a discovery for AIDS, and we actually talked about a discovery for cancer. Oh, no, we didn't talk about it, but I did read something. On a side note, I did read a discovery for killing many types of cancers. And it was using, I won't bring up because it's kind of major speculation, but there's a lot of interesting things out there that are happening. I think we should continue focusing on those.
Oh, yeah.
And stay away from blurring the line of humanity, because I just think it's just definitely going to go down.
Well, I think, here's an interesting concept. If we're trying to make animals more human, then we're having issues.
Well, that would be another slave class.
Yes. And so if we try to make humans more animal, that's morally a little bit, or ethically a little better, but why do that? Because then you're degrading, taking away what we are. So it's kind of like whenever we go in that realm, it's treading on very sketchy
thin water.
Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly think that they're already in those realms, and that's why, you know, I have a fear that, you know, there's people up there that are making decisions about what they should do with the knowledge that they do have. And I think it's going on behind the scenes, you know, and it's...
But at the same time, like, I can understand for, like, the longitudinal view and for the good of the many. Yeah, let's do it. Great stuff. Keep going. Because it's the understanding which is going to come out of that is going to be essential, you know, for us to stay as a healthy, you know, organism.
Well, maybe understanding something but not using it. Like, use it to understand it, and then once they understood it, stop using it. And who knows, maybe use it to fit some acute situation, but...
Except if they can, you know, like, create a hybrid of a human and a kangaroo. Yeah. And make them a soldier. What a great thing.
What a great thing.
No, that was from Tank Girl.
Oh, all right.
Great little cult classic there.
Okay, well, moving along on a slightly different note, this is kind of talking about how the world of patents, companies moving towards open source, like Solaris, Open Solaris, and the, you know, Linux and all sorts of different stuff, and some of the things that are coming along the thought process of this new or, you know, slightly different model of how people are looking at doing software. Last year, IBM took a step forward in cooperating with the free software community by offering blanket licenses for 500 of its patents to all free software developers. This does not cover all of IBM's software patents, which must number in the thousands, and there are other areas where IBM does not yet cooperate free software, cooperate with the free software community, that they have not provided the necessary information to port a free BIOS to IBM ThinkPads, for instance. And they are still pursuing treacherous computing. Nonetheless, this is a real step. This is a real step. Recently, Sun made an announcement that superficially seems similar, and said that Sun had given us free access to Sun Open Solaris related patents under the Common Development and Distributed License. But those words do not really make sense. The CDDL is a license for copyright on software, not a policy for licensing patents. It applies to specific code and nothing else. Copyrights and patents have essentially nothing in common in the requirements they impose on the public. And going along the lines of IBM giving out 500 of its patents, blanket license for 500 of its patents, to allow anybody to use those patents in their technology, there is a few worries. Actually, I read, too, that Open Solaris are going to be actually doing 1,600 patents are going to fall under the CDDL, but that's still not totally determined as to what that actually is going to end up meaning for many of the situations of how you use the technology that you learn and apply it. Some of the worries about patents that we've talked about before is that, of course, a lot of people are trying to get patents that on all sorts of broad related technologies and using it against, and possibly using it against, smaller companies that use it.
Yeah.
And if people that have the money to, you know, rake up all these patents, it could spell doom and gloom for innovation and creativity.
But what, like, the 500 patents from IBM sounds like, you know, they've gone, you know, we've done what we can with these. Let's see what else we can get from them.
Yeah, yeah. And also, there is a company founded by ex-Microsoft executive Mai Herwold, which cheerfully says it is spending $350 million to buy up patents, not specifically in software, so it can go around threatening and bullying everyone else.
Yeah.
Of course, these parasites, this is from the article, these parasites don't like to describe their activities in such terms, such as the mafia when it threatens to attack local businesses unless they pay, says it's charging for protection. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he's going out there and buying all these patents, and you know, looking to rake in the dough when people you know, use them. And you can also rent the patents out and all sorts of stuff like that. Then think of all software that is neither free nor proprietary. Private use software is software developed for and used by one client. Most software is private use software. The developers of this software can also be sued for using patented technologies, and so can the users of the software. Any software?
Yeah, that just.
Yeah, that's just a company that developed a software for one company in particular. You know, both parties can be sued. Any software patent holder, including the pirates, can sue computer users as well as software developers. Threatening the users is a common technique, and an unscrupulous patent holder to hold the screws on, to put the screws on the developer.
Yeah. Because it sounds like we're just creating another culture of fear of creation. Because, oh, if you do anything, oh my, you can be sued like three different ways from Sunday.
Yeah, and limited by those patents. So that is some of the concerns that are out there, growing concerns, as we see this model of change in a few ways that some of these companies are operating, saying that they're going to be passive with their patents, they're allowing use of patents, some companies are just buying or creating patents like crazy. Yeah. Now, this is an announcement from Sun talking about their access that they're granting to 1,600 patents. Sun grants global open source community access to more than 1,600 patents. January 25, 2005, Sun Microsystems, Inc. today, well then, announced the largest single release of patent innovations into the open source community by an organization to date, marking a significant shift in the way Sun positions its intellectual property portfolio. By giving open source developers free access to the Sun OpenSolaris related patents under the Common Development and Distributed License, the company is fostering open innovation and establishing a leadership role in the framework of a patent commons that will be recognized across the globe. As the largest business contributor to the open source community, Sun has always been an ardent believer in open standards. Yada, yada, yada. Basically, actually, I don't believe that they've been the largest contributor to the open source community. I think IBM and actually a few other companies, I guess you can say typical large proprietary companies, I think IBM has given more contribution to Linux, and they do a lot of work on some Linux projects and the kernel and stuff like that. I could be wrong because I don't know all the details, but they're, you know, pointing out that they're giving this open access, but you know, a lot of people do fear that the Common Development and Distributor License does not truly allow you to use the technologies that's learned in there, and some of it has yet to be tried in court. So they're not quite sure exactly how things are going to hold up if you use the source code and borrow it. And in all honesty, I've glanced over the license and I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but it's nothing like you know, the GPL for Linux and open source and stuff like that. So definitely something that we'll be talking about as the months go by and how that licensing really plays out.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting to see all the different strategies and how they're, you know, going to increase or decrease market share and productivity.
And also, with the release of OpenSolaris, Gen 2 is going to be moving their ported system over to OpenSolaris, which will basically allow you to, once you move it over to OpenSolaris, you'll be able to download Linux packages and install them. It grabs their dependencies and is a great way to add Linux GNU OS code programs to your Solaris operating system, so be on the lookout for that. I have read that they have something working as is, and I think you can put it on now, but it's still being worked on. So that's going to be interesting, because OpenSolaris is a more Linux-style friendly operating system. It allows you to compile many of the GNU Linux software onto it, and without any problems. I actually got the disk here. I'm going to be checking it out myself. And, so that's going to be interesting to mix the old Unix and the new Linux worlds together.
Yeah, sounds fun.
Also, IBM, it's kind of, these are a barrage of related articles in somewhat fashion or another. IBM back in the day, I would say back in 2004, announced that they were going to move all of their desktops, somewhere around the number of 40,000 to 60,000 desktops, to Linux by the end of 2004. And basically this article goes on to tell you that they've probably moved around 15,000 desktops, but it's mainly people that are using Linux as their main machine. They're familiar with it, and they're also using it. The people that are typically using it are the ones that are familiar with it, so they can do the tech themselves if they can't figure out something. And then also, they do run Lotus Notes under Wine to they use OpenOffice, but they do use Lotus Notes under Wine as their email client, and they're not totally away from Windows, I guess you could say, when they're using a Windows-style program. And now with that, a Windows-dependent program, even though it's being emulated under Wine. So the one thing to say about that is a Linux desktop really there? And, you know, what's it missing? And there's, you know, obviously it is missing some things for the corporate environment. Depends on what your software needs are. But they have not fulfilled that directive that they were originally touting.
Yeah, they haven't completed the vision which they've set out to do.
Yeah, and it is based on the fact that some people don't fully understand Linux yet, and also not all of the programs that are typically used are fully supported yet, unfortunately. But hey, it's out there, and it's growing in popularity, and it's a good alternative, and go for it. Use it if you choose to, because as we point out in the show many times, there's a lot of benefits to using that or, you know, other alternatives to Windows, because Windows can be a lot of problems and a lot of money and antivirus and all this other crap you can put on there. So, all right, and to wrap things up, this is a new type of RAM that Samsung has invented. They had invented Rhombus RAM, RD RAM back in the day. And that is actually even faster. The RAM that they invented a few years ago is even faster than the RAM that's currently out, like the DDR-based 3200 RAM and stuff like that. They had a few issues trying to pose their patents and stuff on other companies, and it just never took on. Plus, the cost of the RAM was pretty expensive. Well, they do have a new type of RAM that they have invented here that is 5 times faster than the PC800 RD RAM, and is 10 times faster than the DDR400 RAM that they have out now. And this is probably going to be the RAM that's going to be used in the PlayStation 3. So the PlayStation, that's going to be a pretty amazing system.
Wow.
Yeah, they have the new cell processors, and this type of RAM is probably going to be the hardware used. Samsung start mass production of what the company claims the world's fastest memory. Rambus, developer of the technology, Samsung position XDR RAM, DRAM, initially as high bandwidth memory for multimedia applications, and hope the technology will trickle down into the PC segment by 2006. Samsung's production currently consists of 256 megabit XDR DRAM, extreme data rate, that will target now multimedia applications such as Sony cell processor that will support the technology. The transfer speed of the XDR RAM module is at a rate of 8 gigabits per second. Gigabytes per second, about 10 times the speed of DDR400 and 5 times the speed of PC800 DRAM. During the first half of this year, Samsung plans to increase the capacity to 500 megabits and boost the bandwidth to 12.8 gigabytes per second of data pushed through.
Wow. And that's bytes. That's not bits.
Yeah, bytes. Yeah, 8 instead of the 1 bit.
Right.
Yeah, so that's big time.
That is. That's good stuff.
So, yeah, we'll see that take off. And
I want one of those implanted in my head.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what the PlayStation 3 is going to look like. I actually read an article saying that it's cinematic. I mean, it's like a movie.
Wow, that's, just amazing.
In your home. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, I think that is going to do it for this edition of the In the Now show.
Yay.
Yay. All right, I'm exhausted.
Yeah, so am I.
I've got A lot of stuff I got to do.
Put some jelly on me. I'm toast.
All right. Okay, well, we'll be doing that interview next week. On the next show, we should be. And getting that up. And hope to see everyone then.
Right on. Later.
All right. See everyone in 2 weeks. Later.
Thank you.